Our Bible reading tonight comes from Mark chapter 15, verses 40, then through to 16, verse 8, and that can be found on page 1022 in the Pew Bibles. So Mark chapter 15, starting at verse 40. Some women were watching from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James the younger and of Joseph, and Salome. In Galilee, these women had followed him and cared for his needs. Many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem were also there. It was the preparation day, that is, the day before the Sabbath. So as evening approached, Joseph of Arimathea, a prominent member of the council, who was himself waiting for the kingdom of God, went boldly to Pilate and asked for Jesus' body. Pilate was surprised to hear that he was already dead. Summoning the centurion, he asked him if Jesus had already died. When he learned from the centurion that it was so, he gave the body to Joseph. So Joseph brought some linen cloth, took down the body, wrapped it in the linen, and placed it in a tomb cut out from rock. Then he rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb. Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, saw where he was laid. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James, and Salome bought spices that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb, and they asked each other, "Who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb?" But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter. He is going ahead of you on into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. This is the word of the Lord.
Well, good evening, everyone. I understand I'm under time pressure. Nonetheless, it's good to be at church with you and be preaching on this passage. On this day, I mean Sunday, every Sunday we get together, we are reflecting and celebrating Resurrection Sunday. But today, most definitely, it's at the heart of the Christian calendar. It's great to be with you. My name is Prash, by the way. I'm the assistant minister along with Kaz, if you didn't know. Now, those of you who would know me know that my family background is Sri Lanka. I'm a Sri Lankan by birth, at least. And I still have family there. And if you know anything about Sri Lanka, you know that they have a fairly checkered and troubled history. The last 30 years, Sri Lanka was a country consumed by a very bloody and bitter civil war. It ended in 2009. And if you go back to Sri Lanka now, what you see actually are beautiful manicured streets in lots of places. There's not a lot of rubbish around anymore. This is quite striking. If you used to travel there a lot, you never see soldiers on the corner anymore. There are no checkpoints, and it looks like, for all intents and purposes, that this country has really moved on from their history. But one of my family members works in the civil service, and he and I were chatting last time I went. I went in January, and one of the things he said is that despite all these kind of these superficial changes, that reconciliation in Sri Lanka has been very, very hard. People are still stuck in victimhood. Others seek vindication for their victory. And many people, in fact, most people, are still suspicious. Suspicious about what other people think of them and what they might intend for them. And the reason, he says, is because 30 years of civil war is just so dramatic. It so transforms your common history. And you can't really escape that. And so the basis on which all these people are making their decisions and encountering life and encountering each other is this overwhelming 30-year conflict. They can't get past that. They can't get past it. And what's true on a macro level like that for a country like Sri Lanka is actually true in principle on a micro level for each of us. Each of us have a certain story. We have a certain background which impacts a basis for which we make our decisions and choose our priorities and work out where we're going to spend our energy and our time and our money. So I want to ask you a little question this evening. I want you to ask you a self-reflective question. On what basis do you make your decisions? What basis do you make your decisions? What's the story, so to speak? What's the reality? Think of the key decisions you make and think about why do you make them? Now, let me perhaps depersonalise the question for you. Perhaps that's probing too far. How about you just grab a group of your neighbours all together, your neighbours or your friends or your schoolmates? What basis would they make their decisions? What basis would they make their decisions? I don't know what your friends are like or what your neighbours might be like, but I wonder if a lot of people make their decisions on the basis of the following. For example, if they're a younger person, lots of their decisions are made on the basis of trying to experience life to its fullest. I need to have the full experience. I don't want to miss out on anything here. There's a fear of missing out. If you're a bit older, perhaps the basis of a lot of your decision-making is on the basis of your children, a fear for their security. You're fearful of their future. The world looks uncertain nowadays. And so a lot of the decisions you make for them in terms of their schooling and their education, their friendship groups, basis of how you see the world. Or, you know, you may not like to admit it, but probably one or two rungs down is just providing for yourself. That's why you make some of your decisions. Perhaps you look at the world now and you think, Australia is just not as stable as it used to be. We've had 20-odd years of economic prosperity. Surely the bubble's going to burst, so to speak. And so all my decisions are made in terms of establishing some kind of prosperity, some kind of economic stability. Maybe you're just an older person and you just feel the reality of a growing, aging population and you wonder what your kids will do. Would they look after you? So you make your decisions on that basis. I don't know what the answer is for you, but you have a basis for why you make your decisions. We all do. We all do. And as we encounter the passage that's read this evening by Peter from Mark, we meet a group of women and they are making decisions. They are doing things on the basis of one overwhelming reality. And that's what we reflected on Friday, the death of Jesus Christ. It's the basis in which they are making all their decisions and choices, in which they're investing all their time and energy and where all their emotions are being spent, the death of Jesus. In fact, that's the main point of the first section of this reading. If you were at church on Friday morning with us, you would have recognised that we actually read the first few verses of this evening we read on Friday as well. But we did that because I just wanted to drive home the reality that the death of Jesus is really the overwhelming factor in these women's lives at this point. And Mark, when he hasn't written a long gospel, if you consider the four gospel accounts of Jesus in the New Testament, Mark's is probably the shortest actually. It doesn't mean that he's left out important things. In fact, he's chosen important things. It's like the concentrated version. And so everything he includes is included for a purpose. For example, verses 44 and 45, he includes Pilate's conversation with the centurion. These guys are included because they are, in a sense, they're like coroners. They're like doctors on the scene of a crime. They are experts in death. And so when they declare Jesus dead, there is no doubt about it. And Mark's including that for a very important purpose because he wants it to be very clear that Jesus died. Jesus died. And then he includes the women. This is very unusual, actually, to include women as as an eyewitness in this time and place, the biblical time, very patriarchal time. So to include women as your eyewitness, they must have actually been there, otherwise you wouldn't choose them. But he includes them because, in a sense, they are the chain of evidence. They make the link between the crucifixion and the tomb. They're the ones who saw the death, we're told, who saw the body being wrapped, and who saw it being placed in the tomb. And then there's that verse 47, which seems innocuous, but when you consider it in that framework, you see exactly why Mark's included. Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, saw where he was laid. In other words, they know what happened to that man hanging on the cross. They know how he got down and how he ended up in the tomb. And even the inclusion of the time, just after sunrise, very important for Mark, because he wants us to get this, that these women are going to the right tomb. They are going to the tomb where Jesus was buried. There are no mistakes here. This death really happened. And some people might want to discount it. They might want to think about this moment of the Christian story as kind of a little myth, something that's been developed to make us all feel good. But here is Mark's point. This is actually a moment in history. Jesus Christ actually lived and died. In fact, there was an article written on Good Friday in the UK newspaper, The Guardian, which says there's abundant historical references leave us with little reasonable doubt that Jesus lived and died. That's written in a secular paper. But it's taken for granted, really, that Jesus really did live and die. And in the midst of all this, I mean, this is such a tumultuous moment in Jerusalem's history, let alone the world's history. In the midst of all of this, emerge two little moments of devotion in the storyline, which Mark wants to point out. Because if you remember the Good Friday story, if you've read it before in Mark, what you will remember is that by the end, everyone had deserted Jesus. There was no one left. Jesus was all alone. It was a story of abject failure in terms of people and disciples. And so as we turn to this moment, we start to see a couple of glimmers of hope. One of them comes in Joseph of Arimathea. In fact, in John's gospel, we also learn there's another man with him called Nicodemus. But Mark says of Joseph, he was waiting for the kingdom of God. It's a bit like a name badge saying he's a believer. He's a believer in some form. And Mark says he went boldly to Pilate. It's almost an understatement, really. Because if you think about it, Pilate's, he's a religious leader. And he is going to ask for the body which the religious leaders conspired to kill. And he's going to Pilate, who's just showed that he has the power to execute someone swiftly. He so he goes boldly to Pilate. And what we see is Joseph executing very tender and kind care of the body of Jesus Christ as he wraps him, carries him, and places him. It's a beautiful little picture. And the other picture is, of course, the women, who really are the focal point of this account of the resurrection, who embark soon after on the Sabbath to anoint the body. You cannot do enough justice to these women, because as they go off to the tomb, you have to remember that all their disciples, all the male disciples, are nowhere to be seen. They've all fled. They're all absent. They've disappeared. They're hiding. And yet these women embark with great heartache. So disillusioned, but they go nonetheless. You can only imagine what's going through their minds as they're making that journey to the tomb. C.S. Lewis says about death, it's in absence, is like the sky. It spreads over everything. If you've actually lost someone, then I don't need to really describe to you what it's like to lose someone you really love. You really love. It's very painful. And Mark is such a great storyteller because in such economy of words, he really conveys this. The women have almost like a fog of death over them as they walk. They're so overwhelmed by the death of their beloved friend and teacher, overwhelmed with sorrow and anxiety, and the fog comes from grieving and sleepless nights. And they head off, and Mark says, they ask themselves the question, who'll roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb? There is such a fog, they've left, they've gathered everything up, and they've gone for a walk to the tomb, and then suddenly they've realised, hang on, there is a massive boulder in the way. Oh, who's going to roll it away? You see, the death of Jesus Christ just consumes them. Just consumes them. In a positive sense, it's driven them at least to devotion, we'd say, to caring for his lifeless body and granting him the honour that he was obviously not given in the last days of his life. But all their decisions, all their thinking is just overwhelmed by the death of Jesus Christ. And yet, literally, in the blink of an eye, everything changes. Literally, in the blink of an eye, everything changes. Verse 4, they come round the corner and they see the tomb. And suddenly, just in that instant, everything has changed. All right. Talking about instantaneous change, I always remember this moment when I was 13 and it was my birthday. And as it happened, I had a huge fight with my mum that day, you know, and as 13-year-olds I want to do, it was went along the lines of, you know, you don't care about me, this is my birthday and you haven't focused on me and et cetera, et cetera. I had this huge fight. Anyway, there's a knock at the door, I open the door and there are all my friends. My mum has planned a surprise party for me. Of course, at that moment, my whole attitude to my mum changed, at least on the outside. It had to change, right? It's confronted at that moment by something completely different to what I was expecting. And that is what happens to the women as they come around that corner. And here, what they see is an open tomb. They're going to see a rock, which they can't move. And suddenly they see it's been moved away and the tomb is open. And then they go inside and they meet this strange man dressed in white. And, I mean, all the other gospels seem to lead us to think that he's probably an angel, actually, this guy. And there he is sitting. And Mark says that they became alarmed. It must have been an ultimate understatement. And then the guy says to them these three sentences, these three phrases, which I've been meditating on this week and just thinking, what must have been going through their head as they hear it? He says, he's risen. He's not here. See the place where they lay him. Although, we just read it, but can you imagine what it was like for those women standing there looking at this man, hearing these words, looking at the empty space? Things are being said, but they're not understanding them. They're not understanding them at all. Makes no sense. But in that moment, you see, they have encountered the resurrection. The resurrection. Now, of course, the resurrection is not something new. It's not something new for Israelites who read the Old Testament. In Daniel and Ezekiel, there are great prophecies about the resurrection. And so the resurrection moment doesn't come out of the blue. And yet, for these women, it absolutely is out of the blue. I mean, there is no prophecy that articulates as clearly what's taking place here as what they're perceiving. And, I mean, they might have known some of those great prophecies. Ezekiel's prophecy, for example, which is a valley of dead and dry bones coming back to life. But they would never have imagined that they would be the first people to encounter the resurrection. I never imagined that. This is just simply beyond what any Israelite would have expected. And yet, the angel's words to them say that there's some continuity here. He says Friday isn't actually forgotten. And his words bear this out. He says, you're looking for Jesus, the Nazarene, who was crucified. Or actually, he could have said, because it could have been translated, Jesus the Nazarene, the one who is crucified, is risen. He remains crucified and yet also is risen. His point is, it's not like Friday didn't happen. In fact, it's Friday that did this. It's Friday that did this. It's the blood of Jesus Christ that made this possible. As a songwriter's words say, oh, the cross of Jesus Christ is the reason I'm alive. It really is, actually. It's the cross of Jesus Christ why I'm alive. For his blood has set me free, and it will never lose its power over me. Will never lose its power. And that is a testament of the resurrection. In fact, that's why it's right that we celebrate the Lord's Supper tonight. Because you don't separate those two things. They are together the great victory of God over all the great issues of this world. Sin and death and the power of evil. And yet, here they are, they've walked in, they've been confronted by this extraordinary moment, the culmination of everything that the Old Testament has been talking about, and they don't respond the way you would expect, do they? Mark says, verse 8, trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. The word fled, actually, is the kind of word you use when you're fleeing from a wild animal, just running with just extreme hyperactive energy, fearful, anxious, screaming, in a panic. And that's what they were doing. They've just encountered the resurrection, except they turn around and run away from it as if it's a wild animal. What is going on there? I mean, in part, they're just reflecting the weirdness of what's taking place. When you pause and you think about what is actually taking place in the resurrection, this is the most bizarre thing that's ever happened in the history of the world. But I think one of the reasons they run away, and probably the primary reason, that's why Mark is including it, is that they've misunderstood what's taking place. They're still consumed by death. They're still consumed by death. They live under the misapprehension that death can't be undone. And it's on that basis that they're responding. I want you to do a little thought experiment with me. The current Powerball lottery is $10 million. I want you just to imagine for a moment. Imagine it won't happen, but imagine nonetheless that you won that. You won that Powerball. $10 million. Now imagine the next day after you collect your winnings, you set your alarm for 5:30. You get up, you eat your Weet-Bix or your Cocoa Pops or whatever it is, get dressed, you jam yourself into the train, you get to work in time for a really stressful client meeting at 8:30. You rush for deadlines until lunchtime. Then you have a 15-minute lunch. You have a team meeting that's so boring that you nearly fall asleep a number of times during it. And then because that meeting ran late, you have to work late. You finally rush home only to find that your kids are asleep. Your spouse is checked out, watching TV. Now imagine you got up and you did that again and again and again. You'd be an idiot, right? Because everything's changed. Why would you subject yourself to that? Why would you live on that basis anymore? See, the wonderful truth of the Christian message is the resurrection of Jesus Christ changes everything. It changes everything. And in fact, the women's response, their failure to respond rightly, prompts us and asks us, will you and have you responded as if everything has changed? Because everything has changed. Suddenly your hopes have actually been raised. The bar of what you can hope for is much higher. And all the things that you're afraid of have been snuffed out by the resurrection. And so the resurrection of Jesus Christ is asking you a question. This is what's happened, and how will you respond? Will this become the basis? Will this become the basis of your life? Or will you keep operating under the misapprehension that death ultimately holds its sway over you? That's the question that's before you. Now, there's hope, actually. There's hope. Because the story of the women, I mean, it gets cut short here. It gets cut short perhaps because the end of the papyrus of Matthew was torn at one point and they never kept it. Or perhaps because Matthew purposely wanted to stop it there and get us to ask some questions of ourselves. Nonetheless, it stops. But the other Gospels fill in the story for us. What happened to those women? Well, we learned pretty quickly that actually the truth of the resurrection settled in quickly. And they realized their whole life had changed. Why? Because they met Jesus. They met him on the road. They heard his word. They heard the promises. They realized that this was the moment that God had come in and done his greatest work. His greatest work. The challenge for us is, will we invite Jesus Christ in? Will we embrace a new view of life, which says that God has changed everything? Amen. Thank you.